Take a network break. Overlay a napkin in your lap to catch the crumbs from your virtual donut and join us for our weekly review of tech news. I'm Drew Conry-Murray. Greg Farrow is in Prague for an IETF conference, but fear not. Ethan Banks and Tom Hollingsworth are stepping in to provide your recommended allowance of informed cynicism. Today's show is being sponsored by ExtraHop. They're the leader in real-time IT analytics and the pioneer of wired data, the ultimate lens into digital transactions. The ExtraHop platform provides insight across the IT environment, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. Tweet at ExtraHop and mention Packet Pushers to get a free t-shirt, and you can learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself at extrahop.com/demo. This episode is also being sponsored by VMware's FutureNet. FutureNet's a networking-focused, invitation-only event being held during VMworld this August. You'll hear from industry leaders and expert practitioners about new and emerging technologies that will transform the network. You can request your invitation at vmware.com/futurenet. Okay, to the news. Cisco has announced the latest generation of its UCS servers called M5. And aside from sounding vaguely like the British Security Service, what are the takeaways from these boxes, Ethan?
Well, okay, so some bullet points. They've been beefed up. Intel's new Xeon scalable processors built on Skylake microarchitecture. And Cisco making the point that it's a system, not a server. So they want to make the UCS experience more cloud-like, so more automation, make it easier to allocate resources on demand. And they've got new software, the Workload Optimization Manager, which they have OEM'd from Turbonomics to help make that happen. So if you don't know what Turbonomics did, we did a show with them on the Datanauts podcast, about a year ago. So look in the August 2016 timeframe for Turbonomics. But, you know, long story short, it is software that analyzes how busy your hardware resources are, then moves workloads around so that if there's a hotspot that needs to cool off a bit, they'll move a workload to someplace where there's more resources available. And that even includes cloud, and that can include economics, cost optimization as well. How much is this costing me, you know, dollar-wise to run this workload? So again, Cisco has OEM'd that and branded it as Workload Optimization Manager as part of your UCS. And it lets you compare resource consumption on premises. So if you want to move a workload into public cloud, you can do that too. They're just trying to make it all easy. So, Drew, my take on this thing is that all those features are cool and wonderful, but I don't think the boxes themselves are all that exciting. I mean, you got to keep up, right? You got to offer people the scale. Maybe the GPU density on some of the boxes, if you start looking at the specs, are kind of interesting because you got some heat management challenges there, but they're really cramming more GPU into a few of these chassis. But power speeds and feeds, whatever, table stakes, everybody's doing that. So I think this is really about, the management, the simplicity, the ease of use, the operations, and the all Cisco answer. You know, that's the big sell in my mind. Buy the whole integrated package. Cisco wants to own all of your operations, everything from top to bottom, which at Cisco Live, when I heard Chuck Robbins' keynote, that was the strongest message that came through to me. It wasn't about the products so much. It was that Cisco wanted to do everything, because Chuck didn't talk about interoperability with other vendors or integrations or partnerships or openness even. It was all about everything that Cisco can do for you and would do for you, and you can come to us for all the things. So, and this just dovetails right into that strategy where Cisco wants all your dollars.
Of course. Tom, what about you?
Well, one thing that Ethan brought up that I think is kind of an interesting point is increasing GPU density in these boxes. That's a key thing going forward, because when Intel made the announcement about the process architecture, one of the things they talked about was machine learning and, you know, dare I say it, artificial intelligence stuff. Funny thing about that, that's not something that people are using CPUs for anymore. If you go into markets where you're doing a lot of simple computational tasks, GPUs are starting to rule that market. Look at cryptocurrency mining, for instance, right now. The CPUs that you need to get a cryptocurrency miner going are basically Raspberry Pis, but you have to slug like 8 NVIDIA GTX 1080 cards in there to get the cryptocurrency going, because that's where all the real work is being done. And I agree, Ethan, there's a huge heat issue to talk about there, but you know, if you've got a rack of these things that are doing some crazy machine learning computation skills, you can just stick an air conditioner underneath the bottom of that thing and let it go as hard as you want all day long.
You'd have to have to. I mean, they got two, if I remember right from the specs, they got two GPUs they've stuffed into a half-width blade server. So that's kind of a lot of GPU there. And then they got a, I think it was a 2U unit that they got six GPUs you can fit in there now. So it's like, wow, okay, quite a lot.
The big question is going to be, which GPUs are they doing? Because some of the research that we've been doing, you know, there are GPUs that are specifically designed for certain architecture changes. Like NVIDIA is really good at general purpose computation stuff, but certain ASIC calculations only work well on ATI cards. How well? You can't find those ATI cards for retail anywhere. They're going for 200% above retail because everybody's buying them.
Yeah, I'm not sure what GPUs Cisco's putting in here. But I'm sure they have the specs for that. Ethan, back to your point about Cisco wanting to do everything, that was my takeaway. I had a briefing with them about it when they talked about this tagline of it's a system, not a server. Obviously, they want to provide tools and software to make running and operating these things more flexible, even a little bit more cloud-like in terms of resource distribution and ease of management. But part of that comes with the fact that we also want you to buy all Cisco top to bottom.
Yeah, and you can't blame them for that. I mean, this is about market preservation. This is about making the most of their customer relationships. And it's not like they have anything to apologize for in UCS. So they've got a great system there. So trying to sell that to people, especially if they're already Cisco customers, and keeping them in the fold, that's incredibly smart strategy for them. Makes sense to me.
All right. Sticking with Cisco, they announced they're going to acquire the security startup called Observable Networks for an undisclosed amount. Observable Networks analyzes network behavior for indications of malicious activity. Based on my understanding, customers would send their network traffic data like NetFlow and stuff and authentication logs to a cloud service. It's going to look for patterns that indicate suspicious activity.
I know more we're going to analyze things and figure it out with very clever math and machine learning.
I think machine learning and AI is going to be a theme here because there's a lot of stories coming out with folks stamping their products with AI and machine learning and analysis. And not sure how well this always works out, but that's the magic words now.
If there's something to it, great. I think we need to, it's just so early for a lot of this technology. We've had conversations with Dave Meyer, who last I know was at Brocade, University of Oregon. He's done a lot of work in machine learning and the math and the science and the computer programming and the coding that is behind all of that is still early. And a lot of it's research phase and a lot of it's trying to sort out just exactly how it does what it does and what the applications are for the networking space and so on. So it is interesting, but I still feel it's maybe premature is too strong of a word because there are a number of products coming to market that appear to have value. But I just remember back to the old days of when the term wasn't AI or machine learning, it was heuristics, where we could figure out what it was because we're using heuristics to protect you from the things we don't even know about yet. And wonder, on the other hand, I've heard some of the details about how these kind of products work. I'm not familiar with Observable Networks specifically, but I've heard of other products that do effectively careful analysis of what is normal from a given host based on these are the apps that are running on them. These are the ports that they open and the kind of host that they communicate to. And over a period of time, you kind of learn this is normal. And so then when that same host begins to talk on a bunch of other ports or opens up connections to other hosts, it becomes easy to flag that as an anomaly and go, this is out of spec. This is not normal behavior. So maybe something interesting is going on here. And there's a lot of different ways that you can handle that sort of a situation. You could direct some of those, what you might think of as abnormal connections, off to a honeypot and then analyze the traffic there that's flowing into the honeypot and see if it's malicious or not and then go from there. Cisco is no secret here that they've made a big play in the security space, and they buy good technology wherever they can find it because sometimes it's easier to buy it than try to build it within the Cisco ecosystem. So, again, no surprise. Cisco's got huge pockets, and I'm sure we'll see lots more coming from them in the acquisition space for security. And what's really interesting is to see exactly where they bake this in. They've integrated their firewall products now into like one set, which is really a bunch of different products mashed together into one thing. And then you license up to get what you need. Maybe this will be a level up like that, or maybe it'll be a completely separate product. And that'll be interesting to see how they deploy Observable Networks technology within their security ecosystem.
Well, they've been making a conscious effort to move toward more cloud and service-based models as a way to, it's been a strategic initiative for Cisco. And so because Observable Networks is a cloud-based product, it certainly aligns with that vision.
Of Of course, it's cloud-based. I mean, you can't. the cloud-based aspect is right. It's another one of those things where you don't even think about it anymore. You know, if there's stuff in the cloud, it's more like, oh, okay, so you have some portion of this in the cloud. Which portion is it, and what's it actually doing for me? And the most interesting solutions of which are when they're aggregating across customer global data that can form more interesting trends. Not everybody does that. Sometimes it's more about the convenience of using cloud to host the platform, so you don't have to host something in-house. So it'd be good to get a briefing from Cisco on Observable and see what all else they can do.
Tom, any comments?
No, I think it's funny that Cisco has, like you said, they bought a lot of startups that are doing cloud stuff, and Cisco now has cloud offerings, but it's funny that they're all things that you have to buy from Cisco to get to the cloud. I think that's investment protection. You know, get to the cloud through us so that we still get our cut and you can say you're in the cloud.
It is a business. That's what they got to do. All right, moving on. Microsoft has announced a plan to help provide wireless broadband to rural parts of the United States. Microsoft President Brad Smith posted a blog outlining the plan. The company says it has a goal to connect up to 2 million people by the year 2022, and it's going to launch trials in 12 states over the next year. The general idea is to leverage unused, unlicensed TV spectrum in the 600 megahertz frequency range. And just to be clear, Microsoft is not planning to become a provider. They're going to partner with providers. They're going to make capital investments in exchange for some revenue share. And they're going to provide royalty-free licenses on at least 39 patents and share sample source code with people who are going to set up these services.
So one obvious takeaway is that this reminds me of some of these other strategies out there. You know, Facebook's going to float balloons over parts of the world to get internet access to folks. And SpaceX is going to, you know, build a low Earth orbiting satellite network to literally cover the globe in fairly low latency, but yet up in space, internet access. And to me, it's not about everyone in the world for the educational and communications benefits should have internet, and we're here to help them because we have superfluous cash. It's all about, hey, if we get them online, they can buy our crap. So I think that's part of what's going on here.
Absolutely. Microsoft is now a cloud company. People can't buy their cloud products if they don't have good internet connections. This is not philanthropy. This is Microsoft looking out for its own bottom line. That notwithstanding, I like the fact that they're looking to maybe partner with some regional providers, not just the Comcast and the Verizon of the world where we've already got monopoly problems. And it's clear that these monopoly folks aren't bothering to make an effort to service these people. So the fact that Microsoft laid out a really specific plan, and there's a link to the blog, and go see exactly what they're up to. They provided a white paper. They hired a consulting firm to help them really measure it out. It does seem like a serious effort that if it does serve Microsoft's ends, that's okay. If I think people are also getting some quality internet access.
I agree with that. You know, the issue of monopoly in telecommunications in America means that you've got certain small number amount of companies that are controlling large swaths of internet real estate, so to speak. And if you look at a population density, we got a lot of areas in America where the population density is very low. What is the incentive for these monopoly companies to build out infrastructure when they do the cost modeling, go, well, we could put fiber out into all these areas. We could build out, I don't know, maybe a coax plant. But there's hardly anybody out here. I mean, geez, you know, I got four people that are going to, you know, be paying me $50 or $100 a month when I've just spent millions and millions to roll the cable out there. That doesn't make a lot of sense. And so I think they don't. And there hasn't been much incentive to get into things like wireless technology that certain of these companies aren't terribly familiar with, or it's still a challenge to get things built. You know, regional providers have more incentive. Maybe they can make those cost models work. And so partnering with somebody like Microsoft that's got deep pockets can help get the project off the ground. And then the payback period can be a bit longer, and that's okay. And Microsoft gets a cut. And in the end, everybody gets better internet access. And we're kind of working around the monopoly problem, since competition hasn't been set up such that people are going after each other to service these low-density areas.
I saw a stat just a couple days ago. Something like 87% of the people who live in the U.S. have a choice between two providers. And something like 50% of total number of people in the U.S. only have one that can service them. So anything that jumpstarts any kind of competition is good in my mind, even if it's just because it will force the incumbent provider to kind of ramp up their opportunity to offer things here. I'm dealing with that right now. I live in the greater Oklahoma City area. And I have a choice between the cable company and the telco. And they're just kind of bantering back and forth. Oh, well, we can get you a slightly faster speed for slightly less money. But on the day that Google Fiber announced that they were doing an exploratory offering here, they aren't even going to be laying fiber yet. They're just trying to get some municipal laws changed to make it effective for them. My internet speed doubled in a week for free. Why? Please don't go to Google. Please don't go to Google. And that's all it took was the threat of competition. And not just competition where, like, it's in a way it's collusion between two providers since they both own the last mile anyway. It's real honest competition. And now all of a sudden innovation happens.
It's funny that stat you mentioned, Tom, 87% with two choices, 50% with one. I'm wondering how many of those two choice situations are really no choice at all, because I would say I'm in that 87%. I've got a cable operator in my area and my local telco. The local telco service options are terrible. They're not, you know, they're barely broadband, if that. It's some kind of a very poor DSL because the telco cabling plan in this area isn't very good. And we're all spread out over a rural area, so it's very easy to get too far away from the CO. They're putting in fiber-based repeaters in spots to try to, you know, improve DSL service. But still, the speeds aren't very good. The prices aren't very competitive. So my one choice is really my cable company, you know, practically speaking.
Yeah, we ran into that in the enterprise all the time when I worked in education. We have fiber run through the state, but it's only run along major thoroughfares. So when we would counsel schools to get their internet access upgraded from T1 lines to a 10 meg Ethernet circuit, we would have to spend, or the school would have to spend, $20,000, $25,000 to have cables run 4 or 5 miles back to a fiber tap. And I mean, luckily there are mechanisms to pay for that thanks to your tax dollars at work. But still, I mean, 10 megabits and they were happy to have it because it means they could finally get off the two bonded T1 lines that they'd been running on for 10 years. And I'm looking here at my house going, okay, I have 300 megabits down and I could get more if I really needed it.
At some of these companies with no competition, it's like Deadpool's broadband, maximum effort.
Yeah, exactly.
And we've talked many times on Network Break about the shenanigans that the incumbents get up to in preventing competition like Google Fiber from coming into areas by arguing about telephone pole access and dragging their feet in local municipalities and trying to interfere in local regulatory agencies, throwing up smoke. So glad to see some effort maybe trying to crack this nut a little bit. All right, quick break to talk to you about one of our sponsors today. That's ExtraHop. ExtraHop is a leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wired data, the window into digital transactions. They provide insight across the IT environment, from the data center to the edge to the cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. For too long, IT's thought of the network as either the plumbing or the problem. But with ExtraHop, the network becomes the biggest source of real-time visibility for IT. That's because ExtraHop does analysis first and stores packets last, creating wired data, which encompasses all interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, real-time, observed, and objective. Analyzing it at scale transforms the network from just a transport function to the foundation of all digital experience. With ExtraHop, companies like T-Mobile, Google, Adobe, McKesson, and Expedia save millions of dollars and thousands of hours, improving application response times by more than 70% and mean time to resolution by up to 90%. To learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself, visit them at extrahop.com/demo. Connect with them on Twitter at @extrahop. And if you mention Packet Pushers, you can get a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT. Back to the news. Viptela, that's the SD-WAN startup recently acquired by Cisco. They've announced some new features called Cloud OnRamp. They're essentially breaking Cloud OnRamp into two camps. You got Cloud OnRamp for IIS, so you can spin up virtual routers with an AWS or Azure and then connect to specific branches or data centers to provide a more direct path to your cloud apps. Then there's OnRamp for SaaS, where enterprises can designate an internet exit point to SaaS applications, and these points can be branch offices, HQ, or regional offices. What's interesting here about this, guys?
Well, if you go to the page about Cloud OnRamp, they will tell you about it's about cloud transformation. It was just exhausting. I mean, I know it's, will we ever be done transforming? I mean, someday I want to be a butterfly. Anyway, the Viptela, you know, in this case, the public cloud is not your network, right? So what's Viptela good at? They're an SD-WAN company. They're really good at connecting you to things using a multitude of circuits and picking the best of those circuit options to get you the fastest service to that remote resource. So, okay, it makes perfect sense then that they would integrate tightly with whatever you're using up in the cloud. IaaS or IaaS or SaaS. Sure, makes sense. As far as what's interesting, it's just it's the ease of use and the management. To me, it's just integrating it into your Viptela management console where you can spin up the VEdge cloud routers, now they're calling them, up in your IaaS instances, and then plumb that back to home base and have that be part of your Viptela SD-WAN fabric. That is a problem that a lot of people are trying to solve, or they are solving in various ways. So the connecting your public cloud to your private cloud or just to your data center and making it easy to get at those resources via the network and have it feel like it's one integrated network fabric. That's a tough thing if you're trying to do it by hand, standing up IPsec tunnels one at a time. Boo, who wants to do that? If you can do it with your SD-WAN provider and have that be an easy thing, great. They made an easy button for connectivity to the cloud. That's good. And SaaS is really the same thing. I did a bunch of reading on this last night, and I couldn't find a claim where they said, we've partnered with SaaS providers specifically and put our boxes up in their clouds to make it easier to connect. And there are some companies that have done that. I didn't get that vibe from Viptela. It was more like, well, if you've got internet gateways sitting at the edge of your Viptela cloud, you know, boxes that are plumbed to the internet directly, they would use their magic math and analysis of the lines to determine which of those internet links is the best way to get you to SaaS. So that I didn't even think of as a new thing. I thought that they had done that right along. So maybe there's a little detail here that I was missing from their literature on their website explaining this part. But yeah, it's another thing that very logically you would expect them to be able to do, as long as they can identify that this traffic is headed for Office 365 or Salesforce or whatever it is. They would indeed use not just BGP, but their intelligence between you and the SaaS provider to choose the internet link that's going to get you there the quickest or the most efficiently. So logical play, smart, and again, just as a reminder, Cisco had just recently acquired Viptela, so this will be kind of dovetails into Cisco and the cloud offerings more broadly, I think.
Yeah, and just to note that Viptela isn't the only one doing this. All of the SD-WAN providers are talking about providing direct internet access, providing opportunities or options to get to cloud resources, SaaS or IaaS, faster, more easily. So for example, Citrix, they partner with Equinix. You can put a Citrix SD-WAN appliance into an Equinix data center and then use Equinix's private connections into AWS and Azure. And I know that Riverbed will let you spin up one of their virtual SD-WAN appliances inside a cloud service provider to get that plumbing back to your own data center. All right, moving on. This press release from Dell caught my eye. The company has announced an endpoint security suite that now has an air gap mode. That means without a network connection. And Dell is invoking the magic words of AI and predictive mathematical models to detect zero-day malware. The idea is that by using AI and math, the endpoint software should be able to catch malicious behavior without having to rely on regular updates from the cloud. And Dell says that this software only needs to be updated a few times a year in air gap mode, as opposed to your endpoint software that routinely goes up to the cloud to get new signature and threat updates. I thought this was interesting because we talked about earlier heuristics. That was the magic word back when everybody was worried about antivirus software, trying to do some magic detection of software's intent on your endpoint. It's coming back around as AI and mathematical modeling. I'm suspicious of these kind of technologies. They tend not to work very well, cause a lot of false positives and also false negatives. Maybe Dell has cracked the nut here. They're partnering with Cylance, but this is one of those things where you want to try before you buy.
Oh, baby. Yeah. Back in the day, I was involved in a number of antivirus deployments. And right, we've updated the terminology with AI and machine learning and whatever. But right, it was heuristics before. And oh, we always shut that off. It would chew up CPU and generate false positives. And we always just shut that stupid thing off because it was just crap technology. And the scenario Dell's positioning here is for the air-gapped computer, which... not that many of us have that scenario, but, let's pretend we did, super high security scenario. I don't know. It doesn't feel like it could be better to me. And they're talking about math models still needing to be updated a few times per year. So in between the time you're air gapped and you bother to plug back in to get updated or use a USB stick, whatever the methodology is, are you less protected than you were? And the whole false positive thing's got to be... I don't know, guys. Dell, go ahead. Convince me. make us believers. I'm just really skeptical.
Here's a funny thing you should think about. Why was heuristics such a huge part of antivirus? Well, the selling point was virus definitions don't get updated all that often. So heuristics is the only way for you to determine when something new and different is happening, and you can't tell until your virus definition gets updated. Well, if you're going to attempt to use heuristics in an air gap system and the heuristics aren't relying on cloud modeling to determine when, I don't know, virus is all of a sudden using SMB version 1 when it wasn't using that before, isn't the heuristics modeling that you're using as outdated as the virus definitions? I don't know. Maybe I'm just thinking too much.
I don't think you are. I mean, I agree with that. And that's why I'm going, Dell, if you guys could convince us about why this is different, then great. Love to hear it.
Well, realistically speaking, why do you need to put virus protection on an air-gapped system anyway? I get it. If there's something in the room that could possibly introduce a virus into the system, like you pick up a USB stick out of the parking lot and put it into an air-gapped system. But if the air gap system has big signs all over it that say this is secured, please don't introduce external data into it. I mean, you're just as likely to have a world famous actor descend out of the HVAC system to infect your system with a virus. I mean, come on, man.
No, to me, the whole thing is about exfiltration of data when you're talking about air gap systems and how do you, you know, muckle a hold of electrical signals or, you know, these kind of things. It's a much more about that and less about, you know, planting a virus that would do those kind of things, because it's a whole different game when you're trying to pull data off of that box and it's air gapped.
Okay, let me stand on a small soapbox for 2 seconds. If you're worried about data exfiltration from an air gap system behind a secured facility, there are better ways to do that than buying more software. Oh, I don't know. Maybe disable the ability for external storage devices to be plugged into the system. Keep a log of all the people who have entered the room, and if data is exfiltrated, you can interrogate those folks and find out which one of them copied the data. I don't know, maybe put some policies in place instead of relying on the magical IT software dragon to protect you.
But it has AI. It has AI. Come on.
For those of you that have not met Tom, he is a very tall man without the soapbox, so when he's on the soapbox, you need to fear him. Just saying.
He did say little soapbox, though, so he's not pushing too hard. All right, moving on. The Register is reporting that Juniper Networks has released 22 patches for a variety of security fixes and updates to both open source libraries that Juniper uses in its products and to its own software. Problems include an authentication bug that could allow privilege escalation in some SRX firewalls and QFX switches and some other gear, cross-site scripting bugs in ScreenOS, and some hard-coded credentials that showed up in a few SRX models. 22 patches, that's kind of a lot, but obviously better to have them out there than not. So kudos to Juniper for just fessing up and pushing it out there. Also, a lot of these are for open source libraries, which aren't Juniper's fault that there are software problems here. But, you know, again, kudos to them for putting out the patches. So if you're a Juniper customer, check the list, see if you're affected, patch, move on.
Yeah, I mean, it sounded dramatic. I don't think it was unusually dramatic, I guess. Just, you know, the number of 22, I guess, seemed a little exciting. The MacSec bug was interesting that the Register highlighted, because it was a question of how do you react in a situation where you can't authenticate to the opposite end that you're trying to stand up your MacSec connection to. And the quote-unquote bug was, well, if we can't authenticate and can't get our encrypted session stood up, we're just going to pass the traffic through unencrypted. So, you know, depending on your business scenario, that may be exactly what you want to do. You know, it may be better for you to just, you know, yeah, get that traffic through, even if it's unencrypted. But in a few other scenarios, I can see why that would be like, well, it's better to actually not deliver the traffic across that link, you know, unless it's encrypted. So that's actually an interesting, you know, conversation to have. But other than that, I didn't feel that this was all that dramatic. Just, yeah, it is what it is. There's bugs, and we'll be patching from today until the end of IT time. Well, let me take a minute and chat with you guys about FutureNet, which we talked about at the top of the show. On August 30th and 31st, this is going to be the tail end of VMworld in Las Vegas, if those dates sound familiar. VMware is hosting an invitation-only mini-conference on networking called FutureNet. The first one was last year, and the packet pushers were there. Greg and I attended, and we learned a lot of things listening to people who are pushing the boundaries of what you would think of as possible or, you know, a typical configuration you'd find in networking. The speakers who presented, they are not the kind of people you see speaking publicly a lot. So we got exposed to a lot of different ideas about networking. It was thought-provoking. It was interesting. And some of it was even enough to maybe even change our skeptical minds as we look at SDN and some other stuff and go, yeah, and then go, no. And then we hear what some people are actually doing with some of the leading edge stuff and go, huh, It's not even like a question for them. It's like that's how they run their network. So anyway, if a conference like this is interesting to you, you know, FutureNet, once again, it's invitation only, but there are still invitations left to go out, which is why we're talking about this. So if you're a senior enterprise networking person, a cloud architect, a principal engineer, a CTO, you're like a master practitioner of cloud technology, you know, one of those kind of folks, you know, a senior role in networking or cloud architecture, then you're the sort of person that FutureNet might want to have on board at the conference. So, and if you're thinking about your title and what you're doing, you're not entirely sure, hey, just, you know, if you think you might be qualified, submit a request for an invitation and just see what works out. I mean, you got to cover your own travel and hotel to the conference. Las Vegas is cheap, by the way, if you hit it right. But the conference itself, the FutureNet conference, is free if you are qualified and VMware extends an invitation to you. Once again, one of the best conference style events Greg and I have ever attended. If you're a senior influencer in your organization, then you can go to vmware.com/FutureNet and request an invitation. One more time, vmware.com/FutureNet and request an invite.
And thanks, VMware, for being a sponsor. Back to the news. Ethan, you got a briefing recently from a company called Live Action. And here again, I noticed the magic words machine learning and autonomous. What's the news here?
Woohoo! Yes, Live Action is a company I follow for a long time. Tom, I know you're familiar with them as well. And historically, Live Action, you would associate them with managing your QoS on your Cisco network. They had a tool set built around making QoS easier to deliver in your Cisco environment. Well, they keep working on the product and ramping up the product and doing different things. And the day that this network break goes out, they're going to be officially announcing LiveNX 6.2, which includes a new feature called Insight. So Live Action, what they've done here with Insight is they're making more of all the data that they collect. Now, originally, they were collecting all this data, again, mostly focused around QoS and so on, but they've realized they got this really interesting visualization engine that lets you look at traffic flows across your physical network. They'll model it on the screen and then show you flows going from hop to hop to hop and so on. So you get this end-to-end idea of what's happening there. They got to gather a bunch of data to do that. So now they're doing just more with the data than bundling it in this software update they're calling Insight. They gather via SNMP, they gather via NetFlow and a lot of other flow record types, store it in a historical time series database, and then do analysis on it and show you what's interesting. So, okay, so machine learning, what do we mean here? So I actually quizzed them on this. It's one of my favorite things to ask because, you know, like you've got cloud washing, everything's cloud, and SDN washing, everything's software-defined, networking, and so on, and doesn't really mean anything more. I don't want machine learning to go that way, so I try to qualify. It doesn't sound like they're ML washing to me because they made the point that the more data that LiveNX ingests, the smarter it gets about what's normal and abnormal. And that is the way I understand machine learning, how those algorithms are supposed to work. They learn based on data sets, and the more, the better. On the other hand, networking data isn't very good data for machine learning typically. It's not formatted in the right way and so on. So there is a little bit of a question mark in my mind, but let's assume that Live Action has this sorted for the way LiveNX 6.2 is working. Okay, so what are you actually getting here with LiveNX 6.2? So you're getting the chance to look at your traffic, visualize it, and then get the impact of what's happening on your network through that data. And then also the operator can impact the data itself. So LiveNX by default could report an anomaly. And the operator can look at that and go, yeah, actually, that's fine. And so they can tweak the output that LiveNX gives them to determine what's important and what's not. Live Action calls this the human in the loop, which I find pretty interesting because I haven't, you can always tweak thresholds, you know, and adjust what's, you know, good or bad as kind of a, well, if it goes higher than this or lower than this, then I want to know. This is smarter than that. You're actually informing their algorithm what you think is normal and not normal. And you're kind of like tweaking the algorithm is the impression I got about how it worked, which seems a good bit smarter than threshold alarming to me. I think another point here to make is that the analytics world is hot. Oh man, there's so many products we've been, you know, like ExtraHop, a sponsor here, they're really in that space where they're taking all the data off the wire and then looking at it and giving you analysis. And DeepField is another company that we've talked to within the packet pushers world. And Kentik is another company that's in that space. Ixia, you know, yet another one. They'll pull wire traffic off the wire, and then they've got an analytics engine that you can also take part in. in their world and get analysis of the data. So I think the big thing here and the takeaway for network operators is whether it's Live Action, Live NX62 with Insight, or one of these other analytics platforms, is you're looking for a tool now that doesn't just paint a lot of graphs and, you know, send a bunch of alarms and just flood you with data. You want a solution that is going to analyze the data and try to summarize it for you and give you specific action items based on what it has analyzed and what it believes to be going on that is unusual. And the point is, you want to stay ahead of the problems. You don't want to be reactive to the problems. Oh, crap, everything just went right on the board. No, you want to know before you get to that point that something's heading south, something's not quite right. Most failures aren't something blew up completely. Most of them are more subtle. You get errors, you're starting to get packet drops, you're starting to get poor performance in an application because, I don't know, DNS lookups are slow, whatever it might be. So you want analysis tools now that can tell you that sort of information because you're overwhelmed with information if you're trying to parse through it yourself. You can't do it anymore. So, and this is what the analytics market is all about to me. And I think what Live Action is doing with Live NX62 and Insight is moving their customers in that direction. And they're really tight in the Cisco ecosystem too. So, I mean, if you can actually buy Live Action as a Cisco SKU, the way they explained it to me, which is pretty interesting. So yeah, it makes sense. And I think we're going to see more of this from the NMS folks of the world and the companies that have built specialty networking tools. If they're gathering data, they're going to start presenting it to you in an interesting way.
So that's what something I want to key in, because something that jumped out as key to me here is that this idea of actionable, because we've had systems and products forever that can kick up a ton of alarms and tell you there's a problem. I'm thinking back to the days of intrusion detection system and security information and event monitoring where, boom, we can gather all this data and look at it and then flood you with alerts. But if I don't know what to do with it, where to go with it, how to prioritize it, then that's really just noise. So this seems to me to be the part two of, first we monitor an instrument, and then we take this information and actually provide some context and analysis around it, actually make it more useful to you to actually go and do something, fix something, analyze something. Is that what you're saying here?
That is what I'm saying. You keyed in on a magic word there, actionable. Absolutely. So there was, I can't remember the name of the folks anymore, there was a security product a while back that part of what their magic was that if they raise an alarm, it's an action item. There's something you've got to go do, as opposed to, look, my IDS or my IPS logged 758 alerts in the last 14 minutes. I don't even care, because you just get, it's just too much noise. So those actionable items are a really big deal.
All right, cool. Let's hope it's happening. And our last story for the day, Experio, that's a Dutch managed service provider, announced it was acquiring Border6, which is a French company that provides traffic management and performance monitoring products. Ethan, what caught your attention here? Aside from the fact that we've got Dutch and French getting together, and who knows how that'll work.
Right. Experio, this is another briefing I took this week. Experio does a lot of stuff related to internet connectivity for their customers. I mean, think of them as a managed internet service provider, making your connection to the internet cloud services that go well. So they've got a bunch of offerings, Experio does, in their, you know, in their product catalog. And one of the managed offerings that really caught my attention was this accelerated cloud access, which they abbreviate as XCA, because branding, whatever. Okay, their branding, not mine. XCA.
X is cool.
Yeah, X's are cool. Accelerated cloud access. The whole idea is you want to route around internet junctions or backbones that are having a bad day. And of course, BGP is not smart like that. So therefore, XCA is really about optimizing BGP routing. And it's interesting that what XCA does is different from a lot of the other solutions I've heard in this space. So like Teridian, they've actually been on Packet Pushers before as a sponsor, I believe, and I've gotten briefings from them. They tunnel between their hubs to accomplish a very similar goal here of routing around, you know, slow, bad parts of the internet. You got 128 technology. They don't tunnel. They actually use NAT to force traffic between their boxes. And you can do a lot of things with a 128 technology box, not just, you know, optimize internet traffic flow. But that's one of the use cases that 128 tech would talk about. XCA doesn't mess with the packets at all from what they were telling me. Now, I've got some white paper homework to do where they explain it in more detail. But the way they said, it's not an overlay. It's not a tunneling service. It's not, they don't manipulate the packets. They actually manipulate the routing tables on their own routers that live in POPs all over the world and run their own metrics to determine what a best path is and then shove their results right into their own routers' routing tables. So kind of overriding BGP routing, if you will. even though they are still participating in the BGP routing system. So that was very interesting. All right, so the headline here was Experio buys Border 6. So if you got a sense of how XCA works, Border 6 was the company they had partnered with for a long time to enable this XCA optimized BGP routing technology. And so they just bought them. You know, it's got to that point where they were doing so much business with them, it made sense just to buy Border 6 and bring them in-house. And that's what that's all about. Pretty cool stuff and pretty interesting technology. And Experio works with they do work with enterprises and also service providers all over the world. And I hadn't heard of them before, so that also was interesting to me as well.
All right, if you're interested and you want to check it out, we'll have a link in the show notes to go and get some more information. And that wraps it up for this episode. Tom Hollingsworth, if folks want to find out more from you, where can they get it?
I'm all over the place. You can find me on my blog at networkingnerd.net. You can follow me on Twitter as @networkingnerd, and you can check out my day job at techfieldday.com.
Yeah, Tech Field Day's got great videos. I was actually just watching one on Cisco's SD Access announcement. Very good stuff. And of course, read Tom's blog. He's got some great insights. Ethan, if folks want to track you down online, how can they find you?
If they flip their keyboard upside down and bang it around and stare at what falls out, they'll know me as well as I know myself. And if that doesn't work out, they can try at EC Banks on Twitter, on the Packet Pushers IRC channel on Freenode, where my nick is EC Banks, or just Google my name, Ethan Banks, and you can figure it all out from there.
All right, I'm Drew Connery Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsors, ExtraHop and VMware's FutureNet event. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your colleagues. And please check out our brand new free membership. You can sign up to get link propagation and human infrastructure newsletters for absolutely free. That's at packetpushers.net/members. Thanks for listening.